Welcome to the Teach the Geek podcast, where engineer and author Neil Thompson talks with STEM professionals about public speaking, a struggle for many of us. Whether you're a novice public speaker or a proficient one, you can always pick up tips on how to improve. Here's your host, Neil Thompson.
Welcome to another edition of Teach the Geek interviews. My name is Neil Thompson. I'm the founder of Teach the Geek. I work with technical professionals so they can present more effectively, especially in front of non-technical audiences. And you can learn more about that at teachthegeek.com. Again, that's teachthegeek.com. Today, my guest is Matthew Posner. He's a workforce and photonics education director. What does that mean? No clue, but we'll find out. I'm really interested. He wasn't always in learning and development, though. He has a PhD in optoelectronics and worked as a scientist. So how does a scientist end up in learning and development? Well, I'm really interested to find out. So welcome to Teach the Geek interviews, Matthew.
Thank you, Neil. Really happy to be here.
So from the research I did on you, I saw that you studied electronics engineering. What motivated you to study that?
I realized late in life that I was lucky to sort of grow up in a family which really valued science and engineering. And the answer is I don't really know why I studied electronic engineering other than my father had done that before me. So that seemed like a good way to go down the road. And I actually remember starting off in electronic engineering and thinking, what have I done? This is hard and really not what I was expecting. And what kind of kept me going through that was actually realizing some of the applications that you could do in electronic engineering. Very early on, I had a course where I learned about solar cells, which don't sound like electronic engineering, but all of a sudden I was like, wow, you can transform light into electricity. And that kind of got me curious. So I was like, no, I need to get through this and find out what more you can do and get through the stuff which I was finding hard. Programming, which is a really important part of engineering, and find little projects to maybe able to make it useful. And that kind of, year on year, just kind of built up in confidence. And even though I was pretty close to dropping out after my first semester, it's like, no, actually, there's some pretty cool stuff you can do with engineering, and there's lots of skills which can be transferred. So I look back and I'm pretty happy to have kept it going and move out and finish my engineering degree.
Okay. So it sounds like your father was an engineer and then you became one too. I actually became an engineer because my father said I should, but he wasn't an engineer. But so the reason that he even thought that I should become one is still unclear. I never actually asked him, but if I had to guess, it's probably because, as you mentioned, engineering can be pretty stable field. You could typically get an engineering degree, you could find a job after you graduate. So maybe that was the reason for it. And I never even thought of dropping out. I said he wanted me to do it, so I did it. And 4 years later, they gave me a degree. So I was kind of happy that it turned out well. So, I mean, I also saw that you got a PhD. So what was the motivation to get a PhD?
Yeah, so after that, my parents also had PhDs, and it was kind of, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. So it was what could you do with a PhD? Actually, I was always interested in understanding more about, you get to the end of an engineering degree, and I was like, okay, I'm not really sure how this whole light thing works. We're supposed to be doing electronic engineering, which is using electricity and electrons, and all of a sudden someone's throwing light into the mix, and I was like, that doesn't really make sense. And as I got towards the end of my engineering years, I still started seeing how this photonics, the science of light, was actually really close to the engineering. And I thought, no, I need to understand this a little bit more. So that's where I ended up doing my PhD on optoelectronics. I think I knew what a PhD was and what it could do. So I'd seen my parents have careers as scientists and engineers, in the private sector, but also, working as researchers, it kind of made sense from them and our circles that you could do a lot with a PhD. And then when the opportunity arose and to do that in Southampton, which was really at a great place to be able to work between that field of electronics and photonics, I was like, this sounds really cool. And the projects that were coming up were pretty mind-blowing at the time. When I look back at it, I was asked to build up devices which would use photons to go out into quantum experiments. And coming from my background, which It was not physics at all. I was like, that's pretty mad, and I got very excited speaking to what would then become my supervisors and colleagues and friends over the years to go and continue that and learn more and more about these applications and build up a career that way.
All right. So when it comes to the total number of years you were in school for both your first degree and then your PhD, how many years was that?
It was 2009 to 2017, so 8 years.
8 years. Okay. So I mean, so now you get this PhD. What was next?
The PhD was one thing I've said before is I did my PhD in the UK, which is so when people say I've done 8 years from start to finish, they'll be like, sometimes in the US it takes you 8 years to get a PhD. And when I look back at the PhD, actually, and I was chatting to my supervisors, and initially I was always interested in going out to North America, just because the grass is always greener on the other side, kind of thing. And there was a bit of an adventure to be had there. But actually, the PhD, I remember one piece of advice really stuck with me was that it's a pretty fast track to be able to go internationally and have your skills recognized very quickly because you have a PhD. Therefore, it must be something what must be doing something pretty right. So that was kind of the my international passport and how I used it, and that was, I look back at it and I was like, wow, it's during the PhD I got to travel a lot because you had to go out to conferences, you had to present your work, and so I'd been able to travel in different parts of Europe, different parts of North America, West Coast of the US and Canada mainly. And in doing those travels, I really enjoyed learning about the US and Canada. And I actually grew up in France. So in a British family. And so when my wife and I were looking to potentially move abroad, Quebec province as a Francophone place in North America really attracted us, and so we decided to go for Montreal because she was British, I was French. Montreal seemed to be a nice midway to be able to compromise on speaking both languages and gradually settling into North America, and so that's where we set out to look for work. I went into the industry, she went back to school, and to do a master's, now a PhD now. So, and that ended up how we moved into North America.
Okay, so now you're in Montreal and you're working. So what type of work did you do? Or did you go directly into what you're doing now, or was there something else before?
Something else before. Initially, I was working in manufacturing, and manufacturing of semiconductors, which we're using photonics, so detecting light being humanized on the robotic level, or making light which are lasers. So I actually spent 4 years really following a science and engineering route on manufacturing lines, very different from research, which was much more fundamental and investigative, but very high-paced environments. What's kind of happens in parallel to all of my engineering and technical work is over those 10 years of school and then 3 years of working in engineering and science, I'd always been very, very involved in science communication, outreach, public engagement, working with school children at primary level, middle school, high school, and the general public. And as I and that had always been a constant throughout, I guess, my time in science and engineering. As I kind of went through my industry years, which were more formative, I kind of realized there's also a need to be able to keep communicating what you're doing to professionals in the industry and help them keep training as well. So there was kind of this whole baggage of experience that I'd built up of education and training from K to 12, all the way up to upskilling at the university level. I got to a point and I really wanted to find a way to do that more sustainably as a full-time job. And then two things happened. One, I learned my wife was pregnant, and that was a big point of, well, I I'm going to be a dad, and I need to think about, you know, how do I manage being a dad and having a life? And at that point, I was like, okay, so I'm doing so much. Can I focus and just come back to a middle ground, which is which uses all of this? And that really got me thinking about the spaces of learning and development, which I sort of had my first projects in, and sort of managed to buy some time off my engineering work to be able to work in that and really get a flavor for that. And I started really exploring the opportunities internal to my company, and then also external, and what actually popped out. During my leave, my parental leave, was this opportunity working for a nonprofit, which is where I am now, and I have been since September of 2022, so coming up to 9 months, which represented this whole photonics industry, but was helping them address really important pain points of understanding how they're going to get their talent and that they need to be able to develop their products and technologies, how they kind of make sure that talent gets into the industry through the door when they need it, and how do they retain it, how do they upskill their people and maintain, you know, their scientists and engineers at the forefront of doing work which goes into quantum technologies, which goes into aerospace, which goes sustainable technologies and the environment. And that's where I am now, in a pretty cool and happy place.
All right. I mean, I did mention in the intro that you are a workforce and photonics education director. And I also mentioned I didn't really know what that meant. So I'm kind of curious, just is it in your day-to-day life in that role, what do you do?
So on a day-to-day, it's I work on programs for what's going on outside of my company. And I also work inside the company of managing the team, like a scrum master. So it's kind of a dual hat where I get to go out and network, meet engineers and scientists and people training engineers and scientists in company or recruiting them from human resources, and then speak to other organizations in the government or nonprofits who look at helping individuals to build up programs for training in companies, for getting companies closer to, you know, things like organizing job fairs, but being the kind of technical liaison on those job fairs, so that someone who's recruiting understands, I guess, the full value of the experience which a student at any kind of level has had as well, and demystifying, I think, some of the work which is happening in industry, so that the general public and kids in school can kind of see, like, oh wow, those careers are really cool. And, you know, I mentioned before, I've had the privilege of knowing that these careers exist and they can be cool, but I've only realized that is something which you know, I've been fortunate to have. And being able to have children who don't have that perspective, bringing that back at every single level possible is very rich, very important, and I think really needed in a world where technology can, I think, address some really important problems to move our world towards a better place.
You mentioned that you lead others. What would you say would be the number one, I guess, your number one rule when it comes to leading others?
For me, it's listen first. That would be my first rule of leading is understanding where they are at that moment. Because if you run off in one direction and you start from A and they're already at B, then you're not doing the work efficiently for everyone. So listen, position, and move.
What is something that you've now realized being a leader that you didn't realize would be the case before you became a leader?
I thought it could be draining. I'm actually really enjoying it at the minute. The human interaction, building trust and but also finding spaces and making spaces that you can have hard conversations, because not everything is always, you know, going well, and you do have to look at people and evaluate performance. I always was worried about that, and at the moment it's been positive, and there's so keeping learning about getting ready for those kind of issues is critical. I think you have to continue to learn as a leader and not stop because you've become a leader, and by continuing learning and creating those spaces for discussion and listening, coming back to that point of, you know, thing about being a leader, I find it very energizing, and that was maybe something which is a surprise, because a lot is written about leaders burning out, about leaders having to do a whole pile of work and then also managing their teams and there's a kind of a leadership paradox in that way, which I'm not living at the moment, and that's a nice and healthy surprise.
Excellent. I mean, as part of your job, it sounds like communicating with others is big. And when I first started working as an engineer, I didn't have to do a whole lot of speaking in front of others. It was my second job where I had to give presentations in front of management that I really had to build up that skill. And when I first started doing it, I wasn't very good at it, but I got a lot better at it over time because I saw the benefit in doing so. Have you always been adept at communicating with others? And if not, what did you do to get better at it?
I'm particularly inept at communicating with others. It's really not my forte. I'm happy that we're doing this behind a webcam. I say it, if I was going to do this on stage or in person, I'd probably break down and just, you know, cry. I remember one of your podcasts where you talking about sweating profusely on the stage, and I'm sorry for bringing that up on the interview, but it's you know, I would probably have, I've had these moments of being up front and having to do speaks and just blocking completely in front of a crowd of 200 people and just walking off stage 10 seconds into my 1 minute pitch. And I mean, practice is good, I think, to obviously, you know, you can learn to become a communicator, and it's good to be, and where I've been lucky is that people have, you know, let me make mistakes, and I've had to learn to accept those mistakes, and that I can't be good everywhere at speaking, but I can be good in some places. And where I am good is preparing myself, scripting, visualizing what this is going to look like, and being able to perform in that particular area. And I think that gets easier over time. I definitely found that my scripting and visualization have kind of become a bit more natural, a bit more fluid. But, you know, if I come to a new space and I end up you know, having to really reassess where I am, my next tip is sort of bring a friend, and make sure that there's someone there in the audience, whether that's an online audience or an in-person audience, that you can just look at and be, okay, someone's vouching for me at the moment, and I can look at them to make sure that I'll definitely get at least one smile over the next 10 minutes.
No question. I'm a big fan of visualization too, and just positive self-talk, because if you tell yourself that you're not very good, then you likely won't be. But if you tell yourself that this is something that you're intent on improving and that you're improving every time, you're way more likely to do it. Do you have a process for putting your presentations together, Matthew? And if so, what is it?
I put my presentations together. I start with a picture normally, and I look for two or three key messages that I want people to get out from that picture. And it's changed a lot, because when I was in my scientific and research years, I started having to do presentations which tend to be very heavy, and you try and explain a lot in a single diagram or a single, say, PowerPoint slide. There would be six bullet points, there'll be a picture and diagram which would have, you know, size 11 font, which you can't read anywhere else in the room. And actually, I went to training I'm doing presentations, which was offered by professional societies for scientists and engineers that I am a part of, and I participate in on a regular basis. And the kind of the whole, oh, okay, you can say a lot. They do say a picture says 1,000 words, but you can use that picture to say 1,000 words, and it's just finding that mess, that hook, and then deciding which 3 words or 3 ideas and concepts you want people to retain from that. And I found it much more effective than actually going beyond the presentation, because really the presentation is a first step of a conversation. People, if you end the presentation and nothing happens, great, you've had your 15-minute keynote, you've had your 15-minute talk, but it ends there, and then you're not building from that. And so I've kind of accepted that if I can get those 3 ideas in a much more obvious way across, then I'm much more likely to have a conversation and a follow-up, and that for me is much more rich and valuable, and has been much more rich and valuable since I've kind of adopted that approach and shifted like that approach to presenting material.
I'm a big fan of using pictures too. And the main reason I like them is, just like you said, you could be in especially a lot of these technical type conferences, you have a whole lot of graphs and charts and a lot of bullets with a whole lot of words, and it's difficult to read. If you just have a picture, people don't have that option to try to read those bullets. So they either have to listen to you or they're going to ignore you. And I like those odds better, because you eliminated one option. There's more of a chance they actually listen to what you have to say. And then another thing I really like about just using pictures is it forces the presenter to actually know their material really well. They don't have the crutch of reading the slides. God knows how many presentations I've been to where someone just reads. And I'm just thinking to myself, I could have read the slides if you just sent them to me. Why am I sitting through this whole thing? I'm here to actually hear what you have to say about the slides, not watch you read them. So I'm a big fan of using pictures as well. You know, I don't really mind the fact that you mentioned that I sweat profusely. At least I used to. The sweating has gone down. I don't think it's gone away. I still sweat a little bit, but it's definitely at a minimum at this point. Hopefully, you know, it can always go down even further. But you know, it's just a sign that maybe when I first started giving these presentations, I wasn't all that comfortable doing it. I was very nervous, and I didn't really have a way of really channeling that nervous energy or just managing my nerves. Do you ever get nervous before giving presentations? And if so, how do you manage your nerves?
Yes, I still get nervous, and I have to come back to the basics when that happens. And that is sometimes just getting into solitary confinement to be able to, as I mentioned earlier, visualize and project myself onto that stage. I did my first invited talk earlier this year on an industry stage, the big main on the quantum stage at the big conference, international conference, which was open to the public and professionals around all of that. And it was my sort of, and that I kind of came back into it, and I was nervous about delivering on something which was reporting on work of 50 other people, and I had to condense into 10 minutes, and I had to go back to giving myself breaks and days coming up to it, focus time, visualization, and then on the day, making sure I had enough friends in the audience that I could look at different people and look around and keep the smiles going for 10 minutes. And then beyond that, to recover, I think, is going back to the conversation, say, was that interesting? Or did you want to talk about that? And sort of seeing it as a process, which doesn't just stop or is isolated to being on that stage for 10 minutes, but that it is a storytelling adventure, and that you can kind of go through it. And even if the stakes seem higher, there's always a way to get win-wins on those situations.
I think it's really great that you had people who supported you enough that were willing to come and be in the audience to smile. But before that, you had to tell them, if you don't smile when I'm giving that presentation, you're not getting an invite again. And we ain't friends anymore. The only thing you're here is make me comfortable. Damn it.
That's it. But if I can return that service to anyone, like, I will be that person who will now put their hand up saying, yep, I'll be there for you and make sure that I'm smiling throughout the presentation. And if you want, I'll even give you a question at the end.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking also, you could have somebody in the audience who's smiling the entire time, but they're thinking in their head, I have no clue what this man's talking about. But I'm going to still smile, though.
Yeah, it works for me. And
you don't know the difference. Just keep smiling. I don't care if you understand. Exactly. I want to see all the teeth.
Exactly.
Yeah, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much, Matthew, for being a guest. How can people get in touch with you?
So I'm on LinkedIn, and I think that's really the main place where I'm visible online. So it's Matthew Posner on LinkedIn, and if you do connect, please, my favorite tip for LinkedIn is personalize your invites so that I know where you're coming from and how why you're getting in touch. I really appreciate that because it helps me also make a connection back and see how I can help you.
Absolutely. I'm a big fan of people personalizing their connection requests too. I know there's a number of people that actually suggested not to even bother because many people don't care about that, but I guess that's not true. I mean, or maybe we're in the minority, but still. Personalize the connection request. I'm a big fan of that too. Well, everybody, this marks the end of another edition of Teach the Geek interviews. My name is Neil Thompson, founder of Teach the Geek, and you can learn more about it at teachthegeek.com. Again, that's teachthegeek.com. Until next time, take care and stay safe. Thanks, Matthew.
Thank you, Neil.
Well, everyone, that marks another episode in the can. I hope you enjoyed it. If you like these episodes and want to support Teach the Geek, please subscribe, share, and like on any of your favorite podcast platforms. We're on all of them. Also, if you prefer to watch the episodes, head on over to the YouTube channel at youtube.teachthegeek.com. Until next time.